The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Knoll. We talk about the issues that are important in our lives, cutting-edge material. We look at things that are not discovered in a normal course of listening or watching to the alternative media, to the left or to the right. That's why we consider ourselves independent and progressive. Today, my guest, who is very popular with this audience, Sasha Abramski, we'll talk about the growing inequality and poverty in America. Also views on any progress in this area with the new GOP Congress. What can we look at as coming? He's from Oxford University, Columbia University, and he's our senior fellow specializing in inequality, poverty, and incarceration, and the criminal justice system with DEMOS. And the think tank. I filmed him just a few weeks ago for the new documentary I'm doing on poverty. I'm not in my studio in New York. Today we're filming in Northern California, tomorrow Central California, Southern California, Nevada, and throughout the Midwest, and then through the central states and down to the South. In fact, we are getting an awful lot of people who are telling their stories, and these are stories I believe should be told. Upcoming guest tomorrow, David Swanson, one of our more important social and political activists in the progressive movement, and he's going to talk about the pros and cons of grassroots activism to change the course of the nation and try to give us his predictions for the upcoming year. Alex Alia, a scholar who manages to give us insight on to some of the research and studies of the RAND Corporation, and will expose the policies and intentions of this secretive private organization with a history of close ties to the Pentagon and the free market ideologues. Then, with the START Treaty, we'll bring back Dr. Tad Daly, a fellow with the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who won the Nobel Prize. And we'll talk about the future of nuclear proliferation. And then we have Tom Engelhart. We have scholars from Tom Dispatch on anti-war journalists and why we are not having an anti-war movement in the United States today. Those are some of the upcoming topics. Today, the latest in health and healing. Then, commentaries from myself and others or combinations. Harold Jacobs on Obama, A Tale of Betrayal. I'll give my own point of view on that. Also, The Shameless Assault on Christianity by Intolerance and Greed by Brent Badowski from The Hill. Biting Winters Driven by Global Warming. This should be a mind-turner for Glenn Beck and others who don't believe in global warming and point to the idea that we have all this bad weather. Well, I'll explain how the bad weather now actually creates worse weather in the summer. Also, the FBI expands witch hunts against anti-war activists. I warned you a year ago this would be happening. Well, now it's in full force. We'll talk about that. Time permitting, I was going to do my own commentary on what David Halberstam referred to as the best and brightest during the Vietnam War. Last week, Richard Holbrooke, Obama, Clinton, Bush, all the Democratic presidents had used him, and yet they only talked about him being the best and brightest. I'll show you the other side along with Robert Scheer's commentaries on that. And then empowered but struggling, one in three working families are near poverty in the United States. And then monitoring our police state that we're becoming. Those are the hard-hitting issues that you're not going to hear in the other media. You will hear on this. I don't know if I'll get to all these, but as many as I can get to, I will. We will not be taking calls on today's show because of the amount of material to share. Let's go to the research. Oregano oil that I discuss all the time, I take it with me when I travel. Because when you're in an airplane, you're in a petri dish. You don't know if the person sitting beside you has tuberculosis or some other infectious bacteria or virus. So you take it and it helps protect you. But here's the latest from the University of Arizona. And it says oregano oil can counter carcinogens. Food microbiologist found that the oil from oregano can fight dangerous bacteria and compounds that can cause cancer. Now, they got the idea by looking at food safety in the 1993 E. coli outbreak that sickened hundreds and killed 4 children who ate at Jack-in-the-Box restaurants. Now they're looking at the whole idea of ways of controlling foodborne bacteria. And she was studying carvacrol, a beige-colored oil that smells strongly of oregano. And, quote, the idea that something in a plant can inactivate all this bacteria is very fascinating to me, she said. And while testing this oil for its antimicrobial properties in ground beef, she discovered its potential could also prevent cancer. As raw meat heats up on the grill, and I've talked about this many times, amino acids and glucose form glycated products. Remember, I've given you the example, imagine a chicken soft and moist before you put it in the oven. 2 hours later, it's crisp and brown. That's bad. That's called glycation, and that's what speeds up the aging process and destroys cells. Well, she found the same thing, and she found that with a mix of creatinine in the muscle to form compounds that can cause cancer. The higher the temperature, the higher the risk of cancer. So when you're eating things like barbecued ribs, fried chicken, fried fish, anything defried, you're really risking cancer. But also when you grill at a high temperature, you're doing the same. So what they did was they applied this oil to the meat before grilling it, and gee whiz, it reduced the formation of the cancer-causing compounds by 78%. Quote, we did not have any idea about the antioxidative activity at all. We were very excited. The research was funded by the American Cancer Society through the Arizona Cancer Center, and her study was published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. Now, there are three lessons to this. One, who is going to add wild oregano oil to hamburgers, hot dogs, and all the other food that's deep fried or grilled or boiled? They're not. Secondly, the fact that something can cause a prevention of cancer is good. Why not just use it like the rest of us use it to prevent bacteria and cancer in the first place? And why not advocate for vegetarianism? By the way, we'll be filming some people tomorrow on the dangers of genetically modified food in the diet from a vegetarian scientist in Northern California. This time of year, a lot of people use echinacea, generally at 10 to 20 milligrams. They believe that it will help prevent the common cold. Now Science Daily is talking about research done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that indeed shows that echinacea, which is a wildflower, also known as purple coneflower, found in meadows and prairies in the Midwestern plains, is able to impact the duration of a cold. This was a randomized trial involving 700 people between 12 and 80 years of age, all of whom had early symptoms of a cold. They were divided into different groups. One received no pill, a second group received what they knew was echinacea, a third group received echinacea or a placebo, and they didn't know which was which. And then they saw the difference, and lo and behold, the group that actually received the echinacea, which was not a lot, reduced the impact of the cold. Now, here's what I would do. First, I would give 200 milligrams a day of echinacea, and I would give it in tincture form. I would also give wild oregano oil, 20 drops at the same time, and 1,000 milligrams of olive leaf extract with 2,000 milligrams of buffered vitamin C and 1,000 milligrams of quercetin and a powder of bee propolis all at the same time with 500 milligrams of green tea. You do that three times a day, you can stop a cold or the flu dead in its track. Add in vitamin D at 5,000 units, and you've really supercharged your immune system. So the good news is, finally they're looking at herbs in a good quality study and finding, yeah, it does reduce the common cold duration, but that's after a person already is into a cold and only at a single element and at a very low dose. Using it before that, at a higher dose, can prevent it. From Science Daily, mainstream science says the following. Eating healthier means living longer. From the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, quote, the leading causes of death have shifted from infectious diseases to chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease and cancer. These illnesses may be affected by diet. In a study published coming out next week, researchers investigated empirical data regarding the associations of dietary patterns with death, and with over 2,500 adults, and they found that indeed improving the diet reduced death from all causes. Well, I'm glad that they are finally catching up. They also found that the consumption of 108 different food items was able to impact diseases. High-fat dairy products, bad. Meat, fried foods, alcohol, bad. Breakfast cereals, bad. Refined grains, bad. Sweets and desserts, bad. And therefore, those are the unhealthy foods. Finally, mainstream is learning a lesson. Good for them. And also, blue-green algae tested for treating ALS. This is the University of South Florida. It says, the nutritional supplement, spirulina, which is a nutrient-rich blue-green algae, appeared to provide neuroprotective support for dying motor neurons in a mouse model of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. So, now, that's all they said. And it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, Open Tissue Engineering and Regenerative Medicine Journal. What if they then went one step further and said, if we're able to protect the motor neurons from dying, why not use the same blue-green algae spirulina to protect them preventatively in the first place? So they won't come to that conclusion. Their intellectual model that they use won't allow that kind of thinking. But we can use that thinking. Spirulina. I know a lot of you are using spirulina because it's coming in some of the compounds you're using. And finally, once again, we know that what we feed the pregnant woman definitely makes an enormous difference in the developing child's brain. This is from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. It says, prenatal micronutrient supplementation boosts children's cognitive function. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the current issue. So once again, if we give the right nutrients, it can help in the development of the central nervous system, and that can help with overall metabolism, biochemistry, and neuroanatomy development. But we have to make sure that the mother is getting the proper prenatal supplementation and not getting toxins at the same time. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health nutrition. A lot of commentary, plus our guest coming in a moment. Please stay with us. You know I can be found. Sit all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad, something I might have said. Please don't forget my past, the future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm picking up. Don't stop thinking of me. I'd like to welcome all of you from around the world. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting on location. I'm going to ask our engineer to reestablish the IN connection. I'm flying in the dark right now because I don't have that, and I need that. But I'm going to assume that my guest will be listening in for the next few minutes before we go to him in about 15 minutes. I wanted him to hear some of the commentaries that I will be sharing, since we're going to be talking about growing inequality and poverty in America, and the views on what we can do about that. And he has some very specific and positive views. And so Sasha Abramsky, who will be listening from Sacramento, where we're filming tomorrow in Point of Fact, the Tent Cities up there, and he is the author of Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of America's Hunger and How to Fix It, as well as Inside Obama's Brain. So we'll get him on. Let's go into our studio in New York City. We're standing by is our program director, Kara Lee. Hi, Kara. And while Kara is, again, hook up my connection there, I will start by giving a few commentaries. And these are short, but I believe that they are important. Where are the truckloads of food from those of you who are far wealthier and have the money to do so? Oh, I see, it's charity you give it. But what about all the foundations that do indeed help the poor but don't have the money to do it? Why can't we have a governmental agency that's specifically assigned the task of helping the poor as if all charities are capable of handling all the people currently in need? In point of fact, if every charity currently in a position to help the poor gave everything they had, it would be less than 1% of what the poor need. This is from Brent Budowski of The Hill. You betcha I'm talking privately to some senior Democrats about reaching out to the great religions for an enlightened renewal of values. But let me correct Armstrong Williams. America was founded on the idea of religious tolerance and diversity. And Jesus taught again and again about the obligation of Christians to feed the hungry, clothe the needy, treat the ill, and help the hurting. Jesus taught we should sell our possessions and give the proceeds to the poor. Not that Wall Street bonuses should be huge while we pass tax cuts for the rich, while we neglect the hunger and homelessness in the land. Armstrong says we should take a cue from the Tea Parties. I will do so only when the Tea Party shows some commitment to feed the hungry, help the poor, and end the greed and rapacious behavior that is the true adversity of Christianity as taught by Jesus. I found it odd and sad, but not surprising, that Armstrong and so many others on the right wave the banner of Christianity with barely a mention of helping those who are the poorest, and show outright hostility in their own ideology to ending the despoiling of the planet that violates the most basic concept of stewardship. Those who foul our markets and rip off people have nothing in common with Christianity. Greed is not Christian. Those who foul and pollute the planet in the service of greed have nothing in common with Christianity. Pollution is not Christian. Polluters violate the traditional Protestant concept of stewardship, while others violate the traditional Catholic concept of social justice accepted by Catholics of all persuasions, supported by popes over many generations and taught by Jesus with timeless truths teaching the truest faith. And those who preach or practice intolerance do no service to the founding principles of our nation or truest values of Christian faith. Unquote. Those are Brent Budowski's thoughts on the shameless assault. Wall Street and the bankers have nothing to do with the rest of America. They have a different notion of economy. They do not build jobs or factories. They do not go into small communities and fund at zero interest small businesses that have a chance to succeed and reemploy people or employ for the first time and start new, true green shoot businesses. They use it in derivatives, $600 trillion currently, credit default swaps, and risky types of ventures. So it's palpably hypocritical. And if they want the help and welfare, the corporate welfare, but they don't want to extend a hand. Okay, if you believe charities, Glenn Beck, If you believe that charity should be what functions, then why don't you ask the Free Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation? Why don't you ask them to go and bail out all of their friends in corporate America and not burden the taxpayer? Why can't we see this? But we don't. Next up, stop the FBI raids now. In context, 2 years ago, when I was talking about something the Democrats, I didn't expect the Republicans, I certainly expected the Democrats to address some of the erosion of our constitutional rights by the incursion of the military intelligence complex into our lives, the violation of our freedoms by spying on us, eavesdropping. That was proven when it was learned that all the major communication companies were engaged in wiretapping. This was a crime. President Obama and others who knew better, he was a constitutional professor for 12 years at the University of Chicago, sided with the communications companies, including Verizon, the largest single sponsor of the Democratic Convention, to make sure that they passed a law that Bush signed that, in effect, invalidated their illegalities. I said, be careful. No one's paying attention to these incursions. Here's the latest. This is from change.org, from Charles Davis. Quote, the FBI on Tuesday added four more names to a list of anti-war activists subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury as part of an investigation of whether members of the peace movement provided, quote, material support for terrorism. And all 23 people have been subpoenaed in the last several months when the FBI raided the offices and homes of prominent activists in Chicago and Minneapolis. None have been charged with a crime. Several have also refused to testify in what they say is a witch hunt aimed more at intimidating those who dare speak out against U.S. foreign policy than uncovering actual ties to terrorists. And they're probably right. Thanks to a Supreme Court ruling this past June, the definition of material support for terrorism is now so broad as to include any sort of advice to a State Department-designated terrorist group, and then that itself has been broadened. So in effect, right now what we have, so now, where do you have the freedom to speak up without being targeted and put on a list? And there are currently, according to the Washington Post, 1,900 separate security private corporations involved in monitoring, policing, or establishing some criteria to look into the private lives of Americans. So it doesn't matter what you wish to protest, you are now going to be on a watch list. This is what we've come to, and where are the protests? They don't exist. From the environmental segment, biting winters driven by global warming. From Marlo Hood, quote, counterintuitive but true, say scientists, a string of freezing European winters scattered over the last decade has been driven in large part by global warming. The culprit, according to a new study, is the Arctic's receding surface ice, which at current rates of decline could disappear entirely during the summer months, meaning ice, and the mechanism uncovered triples the chances that future winters in Europe and northern Asia will be similarly extremely bad. Bitingly cold weather wreaked havoc across Europe in the last several years, and by the way, it's doing it right now in England. In fact, they've had the coldest winter in 14 years, and transportation in many areas came to a standstill. So here's what it means. When you have warm summers in the Arctic, it increases the ice flow melting, and it releases methane gas and heats the water. That changes the whole circulatory element of the Gulf Stream. That increases global warming in the winter. So you're going to get hotter summers, colder winters, more storms, more insecurity because of global warming. And one last one before we go on to in-studio and to our guest. People are disappointed by many of the appointments of Barack Obama. I am not. I remember 2 years ago, Doug Henderson, who just has a new book out. Congratulations, Doug. I hope it does well. I began to challenge some of Obama's appointments. And he interrupted and said, Now, Gary, you know, give him a chance. And I said, I have given him a chance. But, Doug, I looked at who he voted for, where he received his income, what he did prior to being a senator in the 2-year senator in Congress and working in the Illinois legislature. He was for King Coal, for nuclear, for oil, for gas. He was for all these things. And this is where he got his money. Goldman Sachs was his largest single bundler of money. So that's who the man is, and that's who he will honor. So look for every single one of his appointments to come from this kind of corporatist elite thinking. And he considered himself elitist. He'll be more interested in what it feels like to be president than he will be a good president. He will not be a president for everyone. I know that in advance. And I said, but I'll give you the benefit of a doubt. Let's wait to see what he does. Well, in point of fact, Robert Scheer had it right in truthdig.com. Quote, one of the best and brightest died last week, and in Richard Holbrook, we had a perfect example of a dark mischief to which David Halberstrand referred when he authored the ironic label. Holbrook's life marks the propensity for an elite institutions to turn out alpha leaders with simplistic world-ordering ambitions unrestrained by moral conscience or intellectual humility. Fresh from Brown University, Holbrook marched off as a service foreign officer to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese, who were not buying it. He quickly became involved with a pacification program that herded peasants off their land into barbed wire encampments while we bombed the surrounding areas, including their villages. Holbrook was later successful in the infamous CIA Phoenix program that killed Vietnamese civilians. And by the age of 24, he was brought back to Washington to work under the head of that program, R.W. Comer, on a top-level White House command to save Vietnam from the Vietnamese. And while in Washington, Holbrook came to write a chapter of the secret Pentagon Papers study that exposed the falsehoods justifying the war. Shades of the WikiLeaks disclosures when Daniel Ellsberg, by the way, who we had on last week, in fact, we just had him on this week, and he was in Washington, and all that was filmed last week, and you'll see that in another week up on our website, protesting and then getting arrested. In any case, Ellsberg also worked on the same report that Holbrook worked on, and it revealed to the world that everything we were doing in Vietnam were lies. The Gulf of Tonkin was a setup. It was all false. And by the way, that was later acknowledged by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, but only at the end of his life, if you saw the Fog War documentary. He acknowledged that 3.5 million innocent Indochinese people died in a war that he and the neocons and Holbrook had orchestrated. And it had nothing in the world to do with our national security. Gee whiz, how similar that is to Iraq. It's a virtual template. Afghanistan, Pakistan, same, same, same. Lies and lies. And as a result, he concluded that he could indeed be judged, quote, a war criminal, except that appellation is reserved for leaders of lesser states like Serbian and Iraqi leaders whose war crimes in Holbrook Holbrook would later trumpet as excuses for other U.S. wars. Holbrook not only failed to learn from the U.S. mistakes in Vietnam, he repeated them in working for every Democratic president to follow. When Jimmy Carter was elected, there was Holbrook as an assistant secretary of state supporting the Islamic Mujahideen in Afghanistan, a group fighting the Soviet-backed secular government in Kabul. Indefallible in his hubris, Holbrook also got Carter to support a Cambodian exile coalition based in Thailand to attempt to overthrow the Vietnamese-backed government in Cambodia that ousted the mass murderer Pol Pot. The fact that the coalition included this man who had killed millions of his own people, Pol Pot, he's one of the top 10 mass murderers in the last 100 years, didn't perturb Holbrook at all. He had written elsewhere of Holbrook's arrogance in defending the U.S. backing of the coalition at a dinner at the home of a legendary television producer, Norman Lear. On that evening, Holbrook went off about the critical importance that a regime change in tiny Cambodia could hold for the future of civilization. Once again, he was all about winning the hearts and minds of people who, as it appears from WikiLeaks diplomatic memos thought he was bonkers, as did quite a few in the U.S. military. So once again, this is just an example of someone that was brought in to solve the problems that exacerbated them. So Obama has not betrayed the American people. He did not betray all the people who voted for him. He was honest and loyal to all the people that originally said, be our man. And he has been a perfect man for the corporate state. Prove what someone says is true. Do not just accept it. All they had to do is look what he had done before. And then they would have seen the truth, as some of us did. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are some comments from others and myself. We're going to go to our guest in a second, but let's say hello to in-studio Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, I'll be really brief, but I got this one email this morning, and I thought it was pretty interesting, so I thought I would share it with you, and then maybe you could give your comments afterwards. That's from a man named Bill, who's 44 years old, and he says he's only been listening for about the last 9 months. He says he was a Republican and conservative until this morning. Now he feels like a complete idiot. He was listening to your KPFK show this morning around 8 o'clock when you presented your commentary on why truth is rarely found within any given paradigm and why people are so resistant to challenging their own points of view. He says that from your commentary, he sees the transparent hypocrisy within the Republican, conservative, and many members of the Tea Party movement. He said, if only he had learned this lesson when he was younger. He says, as of today, I will no longer be listening to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Glenn Beck. He says, the truth is extremely painful, and I thought maybe you could give your comments on this.
It is my belief that until such time that we disconnect from the strong ideologies that give us our beliefs and call them realities, and therefore exclude all thoughts that are not aligned with that belief, that we cannot see the truth for wherever it may lie. And there are points of truth and points of deception and misinformation in all belief systems. And therefore, if we're truly independent, we can then seek to make some sense of all these things and then proceed with solutions, starting at the micro level and working up, but not waiting. Right now, the average American who is suffering is expecting a macro solution, that somehow our government and its leaders will listen to their pain, feel their pain, and put into program, emotion, systems that can help them. Nothing could be further from the truth. And all the while, they will not move on their own. They will not seek whatever help they can. They will merely survive and survive as best they can. And that's why when I hear the people and I hear their statements, as I did commentary earlier today, on those who believe that we should not be caring for the poor because it's not part of our system of business. Okay. Then don't care for the rich and corporations that fail, and don't subsidize them, and don't give them cost-plus contracts. Let them compete in the real way that small businesses do, and 99% of all major corporations will go broke within 1 year. And last week, Michael Dowd, one of the Camden agitators many years ago in the Vietnam War with the Berrigan brothers, he said if only all the priests and the rabbis and the imams would get together with their congregations and stop supporting the war and protest and support the poor and demand no more home foreclosures. He said, but that will not happen because they're too comfortable in they're acknowledging a problem but not acknowledging their responsibility in solving it. Hope that answers your question.
Thanks, Gary.
Let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by now. I gave the introduction to him earlier in the program. And let's say hello to Sasha Abramski. Nice to have you back with us today.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm going to just get you into an area, and please run with it. There's a lot you have to share with us. And here are my major points I would like for you to address, please. Why isn't the government stopping bank regulation? Why isn't it preventing further foreclosure? The state of growing poverty and hunger in America is escalating and not decreasing because of their intervention. And what might also be the issue when it comes to our increasing police state, where more people are being incarcerated for small misdemeanors, and yet the major problems that we have seen from massive criminal behavior in the mortgage mess and the securities industry are virtually being set aside as if they're not important enough, or even those people in the Bush administration who got us into these wars through lies and deceptions and manipulation, they're not being addressed. They've been given a clean bill of health. Could you address these issues, please?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the last few years have done terrible things to millions of American families, and that millions of American families who were just about surviving on jobs that didn't pay very much but paid enough to let them buy their basic necessities, those individuals are now falling below the poverty line. So you do see that millions of families more are now reliant on food stamps. You see that millions of families are reliant on unemployment insurance and so on. We have just a staggering level of unemployment and, by extension, a staggering level of underemployment and of poverty. But I'd like to separate out a few different things. It seems to me that when it comes to anti-poverty programs, the Obama administration is actually doing fairly well. It's extended food stamps. It's put on a pretty good effort to extend unemployment insurance. Many of the anti-poverty programs that it's putting in place are actually working. Where it's done an abysmal job is with foreclosures. And I think that's because they essentially were trying to let the market work. They were trying to mediate the market. But the market was fouling up. The market was basically creating these illegitimate mortgages, these subprime loans in the first place. The market was creating this tremendous catastrophe of millions of families losing their homes, this rolling catastrophe that begins in about 2005, 2006, that accelerates in 07, 08, dumps the rest of the economy into a recession, and that we're still living through today. And the numbers are huge. I think it's about 6 million homes have already been lost, and the estimates are that up to another 9 million homes could be lost. So we're just talking about a living standards calamity for millions of American families that hasn't been seen since the Great Depression. And I think the Obama administration really didn't know how to deal with this. And there were some economists, some more radical economists who were saying, look, you can't let the banks fix a problem they created. You've got to have government programs in place. You have to nationalize some of the housing stock. You have to convert owners into tenants. You have to give the government a bigger role in regulating when banks can foreclose houses and so on. And they were reluctant to do that. I think they were, and my sense is it wasn't necessarily a sort of conspiracy of ignorance. It was that they were putting out too many fires at the same time. They were trying to deal with cascading unemployment. They were trying to deal with the failing financial system. They were trying to deal with frozen credit markets. There were all these issues the Obama administration largely inherited from the Bush administration, and it should be said from the Clinton administration beforehand. And they were trying to put out all these fires at once. And I think they missed an opportunity to do more radical interventions in the housing market. And the problem is that all they've done really is kick the problem a little bit down the road. So all of the foreclosures, those are still going to occur. They might occur at a slightly slower rate than would have been in the past. But very few people are successfully modifying their loans. Very few people are successfully taking advantage of government programs. And the result is that many millions of American families who have jobs, who have the ability to pay mortgages, but who are underwater on these subprime loans, they're not getting the help that could keep them in their homes. And I think that it's something that unless we get a handle on as a society, unless we work out how to keep these families in their homes, the economy is going to just continue stumbling from one crisis to another, because the housing market and the wealth tied up in the housing market are too big a part of the economy to ignore. But coming on to the second part of your question, the issue of the criminal justice system, I think it's undeniable we have two systems of justice at this point. We deal very, very harshly with the kind of crimes that poor people tend to commit. And we have done for a generation or two at this point. We've increased our incarcerated population so that at this point it's now the largest prison system in the world. It's the largest incarceration rate in the world. We now out-incarcerate countries like Russia and China, which is really not something America should be proud of. And yet at the same time, to a large extent, we turn a blind eye to the kind of white-collar crime that has ripped the heart out of the lives of millions of American families. And that, to me, is a disjunct, that the higher up the food chain you are, the less likely it is you're going to be prosecuted for the kind of actions you do that hurt people. And so you see this sort of perverse inverted pyramid where, let's say, low-level drug dealing, which is obviously an unsavory aspect of life, but low-level drug dealing at this point can generate the kind of prison sentences that in earlier years might have been generated for extremely high-end offenses, rape and murder, whereas very high-end white-collar crimes that might destroy the life savings of hundreds of thousands of people or even millions of people very rarely get prosecuted. They do occasionally. There's obviously the Bernie Madoff scandal. There are instances in which some people go to prison. But by and large, there's a culture of impunity at the top of the system, which doesn't really serve anybody very well. It undermines faith in American institutions. It undermines faith in the credibility of the democratic culture. And it doesn't exactly encourage faith in the criminal justice system. So I do think there are questions to be asked about where the criminal justice priorities are in this country.
Let's go a little further. In my travel around the United States today, I see people who are suffering at all levels. We're not talking about the historical poor. We're talking about the new poor. And yet, everywhere I go, there is virtually nothing being done that the people can see that is actually helping them. And just last week on a Sunday, when I was watching people line up for food, they ran out of food early on. And that was a sad thing. I mean, to see a family that can't say anything because there's just no food for them. And then I got some of the people aside. I said, you know, when was the last time you ate? You know, and well, we try to eat one meal a day if we can find one. But a lot of these people are not able to get the really nutritious food they want. And this isn't a country that keeps saying we are the most generous. I keep hearing people say we're the most, you know, giving in the world. And these people are saying, okay, where is it? So I think that we have to get away from Thanksgiving and Christmas and look at the other days of the year, every day of the year, that people are in need and we're not there to help them. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, when I was going around the country writing my book, Bread Luck USA, I clearly was seeing instances where it wasn't just individuals who were going hungry, but you could see a community going hungry. So you could go into some towns and maybe a small town where there was one large employer and the large employer had gone bankrupt or had moved the jobs out of state. And so you'd have these hot spots of unemployment. And as you said, these are people who aren't the old poor. They're not people who've spent generations marred in poverty. Many of these men and women, for example, would have had good union jobs 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. And then the plants close down and they end up either unemployed or they end up doing very low-paid, almost non-benefited service sector work. And they end up making these calculations where they have maybe a paycheck every 2 weeks, and they know the paycheck's going to last them for about 10 days. So they can just about pay their basic bills, but they get to the end of the period, they don't have any money left over in the bank to buy food. And they get down to literally the dregs in their fridge or in their pantry, and they have no food left. And in the end, those are the people that they're deemed too affluent to qualify for food stamps, so they don't get government aid. So they're thrown back onto charity lines. They go to their local church, or they go to their local food bank or food pantry, and they stand online. And you can see this all over the country in poor communities. On Saturdays and Sundays, these food lines around the block, and these are families who literally are relying on the largesse of their neighbors in order to survive. So they get free bags of food, they get some USDA produce. Some of the food banks are now even giving out cooking oil because they realize that people are so destitute that even if they give them food, the people can't afford to cook the food because they can't afford to buy things like cooking oil or butter. So all of these things that, you know, you and I take for granted in life, that if we're hungry, we go out, we buy food at the supermarket, or we go to a cafe or a restaurant. For millions of Americans, that doesn't hold anymore, that there are these calculations having to be made. Do I pay my bills or do I buy food? Do I pay my rent or my mortgage or do I buy food? Do I pay overpriced prescription drug costs or do I buy food? And all of these equations come down, basically, and make it impossible for people to live with a modicum of dignity or security. And actually, a lot of rich people in this country give a tremendous amount of money in charity. But at the same time, we're rolling back the ability of the government to intervene because we're denuding the government of tax dollars. We're giving tremendous tax rollbacks to the richest Americans. We're rolling back the estate tax. We're rolling back the capital gains tax rates. We're rolling back the tax rates paid on an array of high-income dollars. Now, but the government is the only organization, whether it's local, state, or federal, government infrastructure is the only organization large enough and with the widest reach to get to everybody in need. It might not do it well all the time, but government programs like food stamps are irreplaceable. And if you denude the government's tax dollars, if you take away the money that they need to service their programs, rich people don't get hurt, poor people get hurt. And that's always been the case, and it always will be the case, that poor people are more vulnerable to cuts in government services, especially at the moment, because at the moment we have this situation where there are tens of millions of people who are actively looking for work and who can't find work. And there are millions more who are underemployed. And there are millions more who are so disillusioned that they've just given up looking for work and they're living entirely on the margins. Now, all of those people, to one degree or another, are reliant on government services. And it doesn't make any sense at all for conservative commentators to say, well, it's their fault that they're unemployed. It's not their fault they're unemployed. The system has broken down. The system has created double-digit unemployment. And most economists think that there's going to be very high unemployment, if not double-digit, at least over 8%, for many, many years to come. And that means there are a lot of Americans, mainly people at the bottom of the economy, mainly people without higher education and so on, who are going to be very, very vulnerable to the economic situation that they find themselves in. And there has to be a fallback. There has to be enough space so that the government can come in with creative anti-poverty programs and ameliorate their condition. And what's happening is, as conservatives start taking over, especially in the House of Representatives, we're going to see the exact opposite take place. We're going to see a curtailment of government's ability to intervene. And I think that that's a very bad trend, because what it means is that we're locking in place a kind of immobilized underclass that affects millions of American families, and that's going to have these ricochet effects throughout the broader economy. It's a very unhealthy situation.
I appreciate those insights, Sasha, but I see a hypocrisy where they're willing to cut back individual programs, food stamp programs, not stop home foreclosures, remember, the average family is four people, so when a house foreclosed on, you're getting four people have to go live with someone. That brings a burden to those other people and depreciates the value of that house they were in the neighborhood. I don't see any effort to stop that at all, yet the president could, by executive order, do a great deal to put a moratorium on home foreclosures. Instead, I see them giving massive subsidies to the energy cartel, the pharmaceutical cartel, the insurance cartel, the for-private hospital cartel, the military-industrial and security complex cartels. Those people will get massive giveaways, and the public gets nothing. At what point does the public realize the game they're in, and demand and force, as they are in Ireland and Portugal and Spain and Greece, demand change?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because in most countries that are undergoing the kind of austerity measures that we've seen, so in Italy, in Portugal, in Greece, Spain and so on, the public has reacted. It might have taken a little bit of time to react. But once the reaction got underway, there have been big protests, there's been organization by trade unions, by students and so on, and there's been a real intervention in the political system, and people have been expressing their desires from a progressive policy perspective. Now, the irony in America is that over the last couple of years, the people who have been most energized to come out to protest, to hold huge demonstrations and so on, have been the Tea Parties. And you talked about them a little bit in your commentaries in the run into this discussion. The Tea Parties are basically a faux populist movement. They use some populist rhetoric. They hang on very well to a set of popular grievances, but actually they're a very exclusionary movement. They don't believe in the vision of America for everybody. They don't believe in a vision of an open society. Much of what the Tea Party believes is extremely conservative, and they've hooked a lot of their political rhetoric around the notion that government is too big and that the best way to get America back on its feet again is tax cuts. And that's baloney. Tax cuts have never helped poor people. They have always helped rich people, because almost definitionally, poorer people pay less taxes and richer people pay more taxes. When you roll back taxes, you might give a few dollars to a poor family, but what you're really doing is you're denuding the government of the ability to help that poor family with social services. On the other hand, you're giving millions of dollars to a billionaire, and that billionaire neither needs those millions of dollars, nor in many cases is going to spend those millions of dollars to trigger broader economic growth. So to my mind, you know, it's a great irony of the moment that as the situation has worsened for large numbers of families in America, the political movement that at least in the short term has benefited the most has been this extremely conservative movement with a vision that's basically going to do tremendous damage to the social compact if it's implemented.
Unless those of us, like yourself and others, who are progressive, continue to raise our voices. Sasha, thank you very much for raising your voice, speaking out, your book, Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It, and more recently, Inside Obama's Brain. All the best to you and to all the people who are helping.
You too, and I wish you a happy new year.
Thank you. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Go to GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to download any programs you may have missed. Have a nice day, everyone.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.
Ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round.